Hi, good morning, everyone.
Morning, Sensei.
This morning when we were chatting before we started and Carol arrived and she said how nice it was to see us all inside our little rectangles. And it's sort of ironic. I wouldn't label them boxes. These are the boxes that we're in. It's sort of a metaphor for the boxes that we keep ourselves in. And that's usually because we have the truth. Right. So we live in the box of the truth. So she offered me a nice segue into my talk, which I think is talking about stepping outside the box. So thank you, Carol. Now, last Sunday at the very end, when we were having our practice circle, I mentioned at the time I couldn't remember where it was from, but that picking and choosing was a disease of the mind. And Stephen, I remembered that you had a reaction to that. And as I've mentioned, sometimes it's hard to come up with an idea for a talk. Well, so I thank you because you gave me an idea for a talk. All right. So what I'm going to talk about is this idea of picking and choosing. And so it was Sengcan, S-E-N-G-C-A-N, who in a poem entitled Verses in Faith Mind wrote the following line. And this line has been used for centuries as a koan. And the line is, the great way is not difficult if you do not pick and choose. Now, when most people hear these words, their response is something like, well, how can you not pick and choose? We do this every day. We need to be able to pick and choose. How can you live your life if you don't pick and choose? So the response to that is that understanding of Sengcan's words is misguided. Now, I'm going to use the word artist, but it means painter, potter, singer, anybody who's involved in being creative in that way. So an artist would probably understand these words right away because a mind that is attached to picking and choosing is not free to be creative. It's limited to the artificial categories that the mind creates. And this is setting up one thing against another. And this blinds us to the possibilities that the individual circumstances may have to offer. So to be free of the confinement of these limitations, it's necessary to still the mind that only sees picking and choosing. And this stillness allows us to live in accordance with the way things are, free from attachment and free from our preferences. Now in this poem, Sengcan continues, and I'll read a few more lines. The perfect way is only difficult for those who pick and choose. Do not like, do not dislike, all will be clear. Make a hair's breadth of difference, and heaven and earth are set apart. If you want the truth to stand clear before you, never be for or against. The struggle between for or against is the mind's worst disease. So if we cling to picking and choosing, it will fragment what is before us and blind us from seeing the underlying oneness of things. Now, I was raised by my grandmother, and I've mentioned this before. I was raised by my grandmother for the first 4 years of my life. And after college, when I was in my 20s, I hadn't seen her for over a year. And during that time, my appearance had changed significantly. My hair got long, and I had a big, full beard. And eventually, I got to see her at my father's house. And when I arrived, she was in another room. And when she walked into the room where I was, and she saw me, she started to cry and said to me, "You look like you just got out of the woods." And so this was not her preference. She wanted me to get back to who she wanted me to be. And my preference was to be a smart-ass hippie and tease her about the way that I look. But fortunately, love dissolved our preferences, and we were just going to see each other again. So we stepped out of our boxes. And had we stayed attached to picking and choosing point of view, the view of our seeing each other could have caused harm to each of us, but we experienced something outside this picking and choosing, which was outside the box, which was freeing and not confined to how we want to see things, what our truth is. So I'm going to read this story. It's about the young Buddha. There is a legend in which Buddha comes upon the mind of not picking and choosing. On the edge of his own profound change of heart, the Buddha meditates all night under a fig tree, and an image comes to his mind. He remembers that as a child, while his father plowed a field in an annual ceremony, he was left in the shade of a rose apple tree. And at this moment, the boy has no one around him to distract him. He is under no one's gaze. His father is absorbed in plowing. The air is pleasant, the leaf light green, the shade cool. With nothing on his mind, the child does not want or fear anything. The sun seems to stand still. It is delicious to be alive. He feels a happiness not born of desire. The boy moves his eyes over the whole field. He can find no resistance, no tension, no inner conflict. Everything is sufficient. There is nothing to add, nothing to subtract. And it occurred to him that exploring this approach, which he discovered in childhood, might be the direction in which enlightenment lies. Here, not picking and choosing is something a boy wanders into. It's a natural state of an undisturbed mind. Then the boy notices that thoughts and feelings are always arising and that they themselves are not disturbing. Thoughts and feelings are things in the world as much as flowers and parasols, and he doesn't have to agree with them or quarrel with them. It's easy not to pick and choose about his own reactions, about his picking and choosing. Last week, I had discussed the koan, the oak tree in the garden, which was Joshu's way of teaching us how to live in harmony with life as it appears and as it disappears. And the oak tree, by its nature, doesn't pick and choose. It's free to live totally in the moment, totally interrelated with everything. Now, if suddenly became able to pick and choose, it would become separate from life and could no longer function in harmony with its environment. And as a result, it would probably die. So picking and choosing arises from seeing the world dualistically. If we limit our experience of life this way, our lives will be severely limited. We will be out of touch with all of the ingredients before us. This way of perceiving diminishes our ability to make choices and decisions freely. Now, it occurred to me that when I was writing this, that an artist would probably understand these words right away, because a mind that's attached to picking and choosing is not free to be creative. And by artist, I mean singer, painter, sculptor, potter, but somebody who, in order to be creative, has to get outside the box that I started talking about. So it's hard to be an artist if you're limited to the artificial categories that the mind creates. A mind setting up one thing against another blinds us to the possibilities that the individual circumstances may offer. To be free of this confinement, of these limitations, it's necessary to still our mind. And this stillness allows us to live in accordance with things as they are, free from attachment to our preferences. Now, most of us aren't artists, but as we know, this applies really to all of us, not just to artists. Now, there was a story that I came across, and I'm going to ask you to indulge me, because rather than do a summary of it and use it in that way, it was so touching and so well written that I'm going to read the whole story. And it's a beautiful story about what it is to live in a situation and let go in a powerful situation and let go of picking and choosing. And it's written by John Tarrant, who was a teacher, a Roshi who lives in Australia, who wrote the book Bring Me the Rhinoceros. So he starts out by saying that I discovered something about picking and choosing when my sister called and told me my mother was dying. I got off the plane in August in Tasmania to gusts of wind and cold rain. Water lay in sheets on the paddocks, and the luggage of the carts was glistening. Their hills were green as dreams. Merino sheep had green seeds sprouting in their wool. My sister took me straight from the airport to my mother's bedside in the hospice. My mother, the doctor thought, was waiting for my arrival and might not last the night. Dying of what? I asked him. Nothing, everything. He was a doctor who considered life and imagined that you might join him in considering it too. He reflected for a moment. There's not a reason. She's just worn out. My mother was extremely wasted. Her hair was baby fine bone white and drifted above her skull. Her skin had an uncanny translucent, relieved by large dark blotches where nurses had tried to find a vein and she had bled under the surface. I held her hand and sat with her. The next morning, she was still alive, so I did the same thing. My sister was negotiating with the nurses about oxygen levels. This was an intense activity. My father was trying to encourage Mom to stay in this world, to eat for him, for life. May I tempt you with just a spoonful of this custard, Allison? You might get a taste for it. She was heedless, impatient, and rude. You don't know what you're talking about. Oh, you don't care. You have never listened to me, never. Oh, Allison, he said disconsolately, everyone had something to do but me. I began to consider love. Immediately, I noticed that whenever I wanted anyone to be different, the room filled with sorrow and pain. Under that condition, I began to struggle and feel terrible grief. There was nothing wrong with this, really. It was intense and interesting, but my mother didn't seem to need it of me. My father or sister didn't need it either. It also wasn't something that I needed. Then for whom did I struggle and feel grief? I noticed that it was easy to think that my father should accept that my mother was dying and let her go. Acceptance, the last stage and all that. And it was easy to think that my mother should bless Dad on her way out. Why not? Or I could think that I should be able to help sand off the edges of the conversation, oil the wheels. With any of these thoughts, the room became small and fearful. There was a sense of strain, of needing others to change, of the hopelessness of the task, of picking and choosing. Wanting to change myself also led to this strain. This was the condition, the wrinkles with delusions of control. When I wanted no one to be different, the room was large and at peace. I didn't think my mother should live longer or that it might be better if she died more quickly or painlessly. What she was doing was good enough. I wanted my mother to have a death that was hers and saw that only she could know what that was. And how my father kept her company was up to him. I could trust him to know what he must do. In the without condition, it seemed likely that my father spoke out of love and that my mother pushed him away out of love. In a long marriage, the codes spoken by the couple might make no sense to outsiders, including their children. My mother's apparent attack on my father could have meant, I've always felt depressed, and this is my final verdict on the marriage. Yet she could just as easily have meant, I'm so sorry to be leaving you. I'm doing my best, but I think I can't stay. I don't want to give you false hope. And my father's cajoling might also have been saying, I'll keep you company as long as I can so that you don't need to be lonely. In that room, I did whatever came to me without thinking much about it. Mainly, I read aloud slightly bleak, old-fashioned poets she liked, Matthew Arnold, Thomas Hardy, some Robert Frost. I read from an old grade 10 reader, a galaxy of poems, old and new. My name was written inside in a child's script and also the name of the boy who had owned it before me. Sometimes as I read, I held her hand. It was the fag end of winter. Gales set in and winds off the great southern ocean beat against the windows, offering a kind of companionship mixed with awe that seafaring people become familiar with. I was comforted by the wind roaring in the dark and confident that as I walked, a path would appear. Everyone seemed to be free then, and the hospital room was large and kind. a peaceful place to spend a late winter afternoon watching gaps of light appear, robins hop with twigs in their beak, and then the rain bash against the windows again, the seeming season beginning to turn. Something else about the hospice. The story in our family was that Mum was often difficult. I had evidence. Memories, psychotherapists had agreed with these memories. But after sitting in that room, not wanting anybody to be different, I didn't want anything about my life to have been different either. My sister and I started to tell each other Mum's famous outrages. Can you believe that she did that, stories? But our hearts weren't in it. I noticed that while I remembered the stories, my body didn't. I could no longer be sure what was intended in my mother's actions or my father's or my own. It was easy to think that what once had once been received as harshness could have been a step along one of affection's twisting paths. In the end, my mother defeated the expectations of hospice and everyone else's expectations too. She came home and lived to see another Christmas. It turned out to have been an opera singer's farewell concert, a rehearsal for another farewell at a future unspecified time. The night my mother died, she was back in the hospice, and I called her from California. I had no particular urgency and no sense that this phone call was more at an edge than any other. And I heard her say, "Hello?" very sweetly, and then ask herself impatiently which end she should talk into. She sounded like the colonel in an English mystery, someone intolerant of innovations such as shirts with collars attached and telephones that didn't need to be wound up. She knew that I was on the other end, but she couldn't converse and manage the phone at the same time. This might just have been an effect of a stroke that she had had many years before. Her intelligence was frustrated when her body did not understand what was being asked of it. I had no grasp of basic Tasmanian. It seemed that she was speaking into the ear end of the phone and listening to the speaking end. That is a likely explanation for the gurgles and thumps I was hearing in California. Like many human problems, it was absurd. The problem prevented me from explaining the problem to her. "Oh, hell," she said, "bloody thing. I never liked it." By the clatter, it was clear that she had dropped the handset or hurled it away. I called back several times, thinking that she might, by chance, pick the receiver up the right way around. But since she hadn't hung up the phone, the line was engaged. The nurse's station didn't answer. Before dawn the next morning, I heard my father's voice come through the answering machine. "Mom died, John. That's all I have to say. Bye." I felt love for him. I felt love for him and also felt that my mother had indeed said farewell in a completely satisfactory way. So those are examples of with and without condition, with and without belief about how it should be. There is nothing wrong with believing people should die a certain way, and for that matter, the thrill of certainty that comes with any strong emotion, including grief. This, too, is life. If you don't dislike your own dislike, not picking and choosing is just present. It's not a discipline or a good thing that must be achieved. On the other hand, freedom is always interesting. When I was without what I should do and might do and could do, I just did what was obvious and was given to me. I experienced this as one of the shapes of love. It occurred to me, surprisingly, at the end of writing this talk, that the peacemakers, the tenets that I mention often, give us a frame of reference for being in this way, for letting go of the truth, for letting go of our opinions, our preferences, our picking and choosing the way things should be. And as you know, the first tenet is not knowing. And in a not knowing mind, preferences, picking and choosing, the truth are not present. It's a mind that's empty of all of that and wide open. And bearing witness is being in a situation, being present to the situation, with that wide open mind. And then the action is grounded in being present in that way. And in that way, we're free to act appropriately to whatever situation we're in. So that's my thoughts on picking and choosing. Thanks for listening.